gather around people wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing. Some writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. Was the loser now will be later to win. For the times, they are a-changing. Some senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't lock up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing. Mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand. For the times, they are a-changing.
This fall, 50 years ago, 1964, students at the University of California, Berkeley, embarked on what would become one of the epic battles of the 60s, the battle for free speech on the university campus. In the end, just before the end of term, the university authorities, isolated and disorganized, gave in, and the Berkeley students had won. They'd won the right to be politically active on and off campus, and their victory helped arouse and shape the great student revolt of the decade. The 60s had begun. This morning and every Friday morning in November at 9 a.m. here on KZYX, we're going to remember and celebrate these events in a special series on the free speech movement. I'm Cal Winslow. I'll be your host. This morning we'll talk with two people, Robert Cohen, a professor of history at New York University and the author of Freedom's Orator, Mario Savio and the Legacy of the 1960s. This fall, this term, Robbie is visiting UC Berkeley, teaching in the history department and lecturing on the events of 1964 and their legacy. And second, Jack Weinberg. Jack was a leader of the free speech movement. His arrest on October 1st, in many ways, was the spark that ignited the rebellion. Jack was an anti-war activist at Berkeley. He was active in the trade union movement in the 70s and later became an organizer for Greenpeace. He lives in Chicago, where he remains engaged, now as a consultant on environmental issues. But first, Mario Savio.
We were told the following: if President Kerr actually tried to get something more liberal out of the regents in his telephone conversations, why didn't he make some public statement to that effect? And the answer we received from a well-meaning liberal was the following. He said, would you ever imagine the manager of a firm making a statement publicly in opposition to his board of directors? That's the answer. Well, I ask you to consider. If this is a firm, and if the Board of Regents are the Board of Directors, and if President Kerr, in fact, is the manager, then I tell you something, the faculty are a bunch of employees, and we're the raw materials. But we're a bunch of raw materials that don't mean to be have any process upon us, don't mean to be made into any product, don't mean to end up being bought by some clients of the university, be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone, or human beings.
Professor Cohen, or Robbie, if you don't mind.
Sure.
You're teaching a course this fall as a visiting professor on the free speech movement. I wondered if you could tell us, if it's possible briefly, just what was the free speech movement, the FSM? What do you tell your students to get them interested at the start?
Well, the free speech movement was basically what its title says. It was about, it was a conflict over freedom of speech. It was provoked by the administration of the University of California, because the University of California had a long-standing free speech problem that dated back to the 1930s. Even though the university academically was gaining stature, you know, Nobel Prizes and all kinds of great things were happening academically, from the 30s on forward, politically the campus was really kind of a mess. The university, really right after the general strike in San Francisco in 1934, where there was a kind of a red scare on the West Coast, adopted all these political restrictions to keep politics off the political demonstrations off the campus. And basically, the 30s were a bit like the 60s. There was a lot of student protest, the first mass student movement in American history, very much influenced by the left. And the university, in part because they were afraid of funding, losing funding from the legislature, upsetting its right wing, the university did two things back then. One, it pushed student protest and demonstrations off the campus, starting what was called the Seder Gate tradition, which meant that you could have demonstrations right outside the campus. Now, just think about that. Seder Gate was the southern entrance.
Mm-hmm.
That you have more free speech off campus than on campus. That's one piece of it. The other piece was sort of covert, and this is in my first book. It was called When the Old Left Was Young, a student protest in the 30s, covertly, the Sproul administration began gathering intelligence on student radicals from local law enforcement authorities. So they really were trying to keep the university free of radicalism. And then these rules were so restricted, it started applying not just to radicals, but to almost all politics. Unless the president specifically authorized it, a demonstration could not be held on campus. So that tradition had been there since the 30s. And really, President Kerr came in and made some modifications, like eventually communists were allowed to speak on campus. But political advocacy was still barred from campus. That is, you couldn't do political speech making or fundraising, partisan activity on campus. And so as the campus expanded and the Sproul Plaza area was built, then the free speech area moved to the Bancroft and Telegraph sidewalk strip off the campus. So again, it's still that tradition called the Seder Gate tradition. But that tradition is on one hand, it's a free speech tradition, but it's also an unfree speech tradition in that the speech has to occur off campus. And what sparked the free speech movement in the fall of 64 was when these restrictions on political advocacy began to be applied to the Bancroft Telegraph strip of sidewalk right outside the campus's entrance. Because what they found out that fall, the administration found out over the summer that the Bancroft Telegraph strip, which they thought was off campus, that sidewalk was actually partially on campus. And so then they tried to apply those restrictions. And so the students who at that time were very much involved in civil rights protests, and that's what sparked a lot of this concern about, you know, how the strip was being used, they were not really willing to have their free speech rights violated because they saw this as an attack on the student wing of the civil rights movement. So in that sense, the free speech movement is a extension of the civil rights movement, of the black freedom movement. That is, the kinds of activities that the students were doing that were upsetting the administration and local right-wingers in the legislature were linked to the civil rights movement. All during the spring of 64, this is the semester before the FSM, students were engaged in lots of protests in the Bay Area against racist hiring practices of the major employers. You know, in the South, the issue was, are African Americans going to be served by commercial establishments? That's what the lunch counter citizens were about that began in Greensboro in 1960. Here, the issue was not serving, it was about hiring. Would they hire African Americans at places like the Sheraton Palace Hotel or Auto Row? Some of these major employers were not hiring African Americans in any kind of numbers and only in very menial capacity. So the students were protesting, and Mario Savio and a number of the other activists in the free speech movement, the leaders, existed in these protests. The biggest one was the Sheraton Palace Hotel in March of 64. And in part because of those protests, pressure began to put on the administration, how can you use the university as a base for organizing attacks on the community? Now, the students didn't see these as attacks on the community. They saw them as attacks on racism of employers in the community and trying to get the employers to change. And by the way, these protests in the spring semester, mostly they won. They got the employers, the hotel association, to agree to a fair hiring agreement. So they were successful, and that was also part of the reason why pressure came down on the administration. The immediate pressure that led to the closing of the Bancroft Telegraph strip was also linked to civil rights, because in the summer of 64, the Republican Party was holding its national convention in the Cow Palace, and the person who was going to get the nomination was Barry Goldwater, as I'm sure you know, was a right-wing Republican who was opposed to the Civil Rights Act. And the students were actually recruiting from the Bancroft Strip people to protest against Goldwater's civil rights position and to support the moderate Republican, William Scranton, who had been the governor of Pennsylvania, who was pro-civil rights. And it was those protests that led the Oakland Tribune, which was a paper that was edited by Bill Nolan, who was a Goldwater supporter, to inquire how are these students being organized to go do these civil rights protests, anti-Goldwater protests, from the campus, even though the campus is supposed to be neutral. Well, it turned out, of course, they weren't really organizing it from the campus. They were organizing it from the Bancroft and Telegraph Strip. But the reporter who came out to inquire, his name was Carl Irving, he started asking questions and realized that some of those, they have these little tables where students were organizing from, that those tables were partially right over the little plaques that said property of the Regents of the University of California, so that they were partially on campus. That's how that discovery happened. So I guess in a nutshell, it's about kind of a backlash against the student wing of the civil rights movement, and it's also about students trying to assert their right to free speech and to be able to participate in the Black Freedom Movement. So that's the immediate background. I also want to point out there's been a lot of, over the years, in part because of Ronald Reagan, a lot of distortions about the free speech movement. Like the idea is that the students at Berkeley in 64, you know, you snap your finger and they'll try to take over a building. They were just trying to disrupt the university. When actually the students in the fall of 64 had no intention of disrupting the university, they had no interest in changing the university. They were trying, the big thrust of the student movement in the fall of 64 at the start was to continue their civil rights work that I'd mentioned before, that is the anti-discrimination work in the Bay Area, supporting the Southern freedom struggle like Mississippi Summer that had happened the summer before. So they weren't planning to do anything about the university. They didn't disrupt the university. It's the opposite. The university disrupted their activism. The university came down and said, no, you can't use this strip anymore to do your political organizing. And even when that happened, the students didn't immediately say, well, we're going to take over a building or we're going to disrupt the university. No, they spent 2 weeks negotiating because they thought this is such a ridiculous rule, the university can't be serious. And it was only after, like, basically almost 2 weeks of negotiating when they realized the university was not going to end its ban that they then moved to just outright defiance of the ban. And things escalated in part because the administration first tried to cite the students to discipline them, and then tried to arrest Jack Weinberg on Sproul Plaza for doing this political organizing for the civil rights movement. So what I'm saying to you is that the image of, you know, the Berkeley students were sort of wild-eyed radicals are trying to you know, disrupt the university. That's a real distortion about what was happening. Their real goal at the beginning of that semester was to continue their activism off campus. The only reason why they started to turn their attention on campus is because the university, with its hoary restrictions on free speech, was really trying to stifle their activism. And so the students felt like they had no choice, but they had to try to defy this ban. So
okay.
That's a bit of introduction. To
yeah, sure. That's, sure, that's great, and thanks. And well, here's another question. The FSM and seems to really have been a triumph for these students in this conflict 50 years ago this month. And students didn't always triumph. Do you think that there was, well, do you think that's true? And do you think there was something about the way they organized and mobilized or about their tactics or values that made them successful?
Oh, yeah. I mean, first of all, on the Berkeley campus for decades, the students have been trying to resist these different restrictions. I mean, the restrictions on free speech at Berkeley were really ridiculous. Like, you couldn't take, the student government could not take a position on an off-campus political issue. And so, like, you know, if it came to, you know, Bull O'Connor or some horrible attack on civil rights protesters in the South, the student government could not take a position on it. You know, and so and lots of times over the years, the students tried to, you know, to protest these restrictions. But the difference was that in 1964, in part because of the impact of the civil rights movement, the students now had something that they hadn't had really before, never used on campus, that is, nonviolent sit-ins, that is, using civil disobedience gave them, I would call it like the great equalizer, it gave them the leverage to finally push back against these restrictions, which the university had no, really no interest in getting rid of, because in a way, it provided them political cover from the legislature. They could say, you know, we don't allow radicalism on campus. We don't allow politics on campus, like we're neutral. Which, of course, in its own way is kind of ridiculous when the university was involved in designing nuclear weapons and supporting agribusiness. You know, the university was never politically neutral, but it could claim this neutrality. And anyway, over the years, the students had tried, you know, there's an organization called Slate, which was basically a campus political party that was sort of left liberal, that was pushing back against these restrictions. Like, you know, earlier in the 60s, even in the late 50s, when students wanted to support a local fair housing ballot initiative, the university wouldn't let them do that. And they always were suppressing Slate, these students, and so they tried to resist. But what gave things this real dramatic difference in 64 was the students, in part because they had spent all the summer, all the spring and part of the summer, doing civil disobedience, and others had been like Mario working in the Deep South and risking their lives, they were now willing to be more defiant and say, you know, we're not going to accept this political or these political restrictions anymore. We want freedom of speech, and if you're not going to do this, then we're going to sit in. In other words, they were forced to be in that position. They tried to go through channels, they tried to negotiate, and the administration just wouldn't change these rules. So they always were asking the students to compromise. And when you compromise on free speech, you don't have free speech. So basically, that was the difference. They were able to use nonviolent civil disobedience to organize. The other thing that helped them was the kind of, I would say, it was the awkwardness, the clumsiness, the heavy-handedness, even the stupidity of the administration. Just imagine, you know, if you were going to try to suppress this defiance of the free speech ban, the way to do it would not be to try to arrest a civil rights protester in the middle of the plaza, Sproul Plaza, in the middle of the day at lunchtime when thousands of students are getting out of classes going to lunch and bringing a police car, you know, onto campus to show everybody what's going on. I mean, you couldn't even imagine anything more sort of really more provocative, right? So, and they continually did stupid things like that. And the thing was that the free speech movement, I think what helped to make it so effective was that it was really open. There's almost a Gandhian piece to it of trying to convince people that their position was right. And even to listen to people who oppose you. You know, when they surrounded that police car, when they tried to arrest Jack Weinberg on October 1st, 64, for doing that civil rights leafleting on campus and speaking on campus right on Sproul steps, and the police car came, and they dragged him to the car. Well, first of all, he went limp. That shows that, you know, having this experienced cadre of civil rights activists, Jack had been a leader of campus core. He had dropped out of graduate school in math to work full-time in the civil rights movement and had been involved in a number of civil rights fair hiring protests. So he was experienced at this. And then when he's in the car, Mario Savio takes off his shoes so as not to damage the car and then climbs atop the car and starts explaining to people what's going on. You know, that this is unjust, that you really should rally around and sit in around the car to support free speech. And that sit-in lasted 32 hours, right? And here's the thing that's interesting about it. You ask, like, why they were successful. One, I think, because they were really open to dialogue. And some of the people from that car, they allowed opponents of the sit-in to speak around that car, too. If you listen to the tapes, the FSM was not afraid to have opponents speak because they thought they had the superior argument. So that's one piece of it, you know, really trying to explain to the student body, you know, what's going on and why you should care. Not a, you know, I'm more radical now kind of position. No, we're trying to be inclusive. That was one piece of it. Another piece of it was that they were very willing to be strategic and tactical. And what that meant in the case of the police car sit-in was, if you just imagine the scene, thousands of students are surrounding this police car, the police have gathered, and they may try to disrupt the thing by force to take the car back. And so what does that mean? That could be like a Kent State type of situation. And what the FSM leadership, and by the way, at that point it wasn't even called a free speech movement, it was called the United Front, The FSM was informed the weekend after the sit-in around the car. But what did they do? They were willing to negotiate with the administration. And, you know, it was controversial among themselves, but they did come to an agreement. It's called the Pact of October 2nd. And that pact enabled the students to do two things. One, it said that the free speech regulations were going to be reviewed by a student administration faculty committee. And then the students who were being disciplined, their disciplinary cases would be taken by a faculty committee, not by the administration. And the third thing was the administration agreed not to press charges against Jack Weinberg, the guy who was in the car. So the point is, here's what happened. The students did a strategic, I would say, you could say it was a strategic retreat, saying, look, we want to get this settled without people getting hurt or killed. So let's see if we can go back to the negotiating table. And you know, Mario's most famous speech, Mario Salvia's, was, you know, there's a time when the operation of the machine, everybody remembers that speech on December 2nd when he called people out to try to disobedience in the FSM's culminating sit-in. But what's not remembered, because it doesn't fit in with the image of the militant 60s, is Mario getting back on the police car that night of October 3rd when they signed this pact and saying, look, I think we should accept this in good faith and rise and with dignity and go home. You know, he's telling people to go home. Let's take this up and see if we can't push this through negotiations. So, and then for the next few weeks, the free speech movement did try to negotiate with the administration. It was only when it was really clear the administration still wanted to retain the right to bar illegal advocacy that the protests were renewed. And what the issue, here was the issue. The free speech issue changed over the course of the FSM. Initially, the administration barred all political advocacy from the campus. That was the first position that caused the protest. Then after the initial negotiations in September, they said that you can have tables on the strip, but you can inform, not advocate, which is ridiculous. You know, I mean, how can you make a distinction and saying you can't advocate? These are political advocacy organizations. And then when they went into negotiations after the police car, the issue then shifted. The administration was saying you can do political advocacy, but you can't advocate something illegal. And what that meant was you couldn't advocate sit-ins or protests that led to sit-ins, because sit-ins were civil disobedience, and that was illegal. And, of course, that was unacceptable to the student activists, because many of them were civil rights activists. They didn't want to bar themselves from being able to advocate civil rights protests to fight racism using civil disobedience. But the larger point is that part of the reason I think they won was, first of all, they had a very coherent goal that is totally within the American tradition, that we're supposed to be committed to free speech, but we weren't really living up to it. That was one piece. They were nonviolent. And they were very strategic about, you know, it was trying to push the administration to doing what they thought of as being the right thing, and then not being hyper-militant, but trying to organize things in a way that will bring the rest of the campus along. See, because the majority of people on campus in Berkeley in 1964 were not radicals. They were moderates and liberals. And if you wanted to get them, you had to make them, basically politically educate them to see that the administration was being politically repressive and was not going to end its repression unless the free speech movement escalated its tactics and ended up using civil disobedience.
Okay.
So what I'm saying is I think that what was really important about this movement was that it had a very winnable and coherent and admirable goal. And the way that it promoted it was through tactics that were quite reasonable. And on top of all that, it had some really talented leaders and a very eloquent spokesperson, Mario Salvia, who could, because of his own background, he'd been active in the Bay Area civil rights movement, and then he'd risked his life and attacked by the Klan in Mississippi in Freedom Summer, and he was extremely eloquent in explaining the civil liberties issues that were at stake and trying to explain why civil disobedience in the end was necessary, because the administration was not willing to reason or to negotiate in good faith. It was too hung up on having the power to restrict speech. So, and Mario could speak in a way that could appeal to faculty and graduate students, because he sounded like a graduate student. He's such a brilliant student. He could appeal to the students. He had a way of kind of like, I think, really of articulating the moral urgency of this cause. And partially, it's the civil rights connection. You know, that it's not like, this is not really some technicality about where you can speak on campus and so forth. This is about the most, in his view, the most moral cause that's going on in 1964 in America is the struggle against racism. And what is the University of California's role in that? You know, he said he felt like the University of California was part of the free part of the country, and that should be closed down. And if the university was closing its campus down to the civil rights movement, it was, for all intents and purposes, in his view, aligning itself with the state of Mississippi. Now, you might think, well, that's not fair. You know, Clark Kerr was a liberal and so forth. But the objective reality in terms of the consequences was if these restrictions had been able to stick, then it really would have damaged the student wing of the civil rights movement. So I think that part of the reason why the movement succeeded was it got connected to the moral urgency of the civil rights movement itself. And also it had a core of activists like Savio and Jack Weinberg and others who were civil rights movement veterans. So when the administration was dealing with these student protesters, it wasn't dealing with naive, inexperienced kids who they could push around. They were dealing with people who'd stood up to the Klan in Mississippi and to racist sheriffs in Mississippi like Mario, or people like Bettina Aptecker and Jack Weinberg who had organized civil rights protests in the Bay Area and there had been arrests there. So my point is that the civil rights movement kind of invested kind of moral capital and political experience in the movement that made it its leadership, I think, very, very adept at dealing with political conflict and keeping its eye on the main issue and not getting distracted and really sort of seeing the need to build a movement. And remember, at this point, the civil rights movement was very much into sort of organizing at the grassroots. It wasn't just a lot of speechifying or heavy rhetoric. It was about, you know, like the SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the South, embedding yourself in the black community and organizing on behalf of voting rights, or in the Bay Area, you know, working in coalition with the black community to try to get rid of hiring discrimination. So what I'm saying is there were a core of people who were very experienced as organizers. And then because of the way they organized and the nature of the issue, both free speech and the struggle against racism, it had a sense of moral urgency about it. And the last piece about it was, as I alluded to earlier, the administration was so heavy-handed, they kept trying to really kind of pick off the leadership by different times to attempt to discipline them. And it was really clear, and this is even the faculty committee called the Hayman Committee that investigated, it said that they were like picking off leaders who were like no more guilty of violations than non-leaders, but picking them off almost as hostages. This is a faculty's framing. Mm. You know? So that really angered people, because what happened was you took the free speech issue, which was connected to the civil rights movement, and then added to a kind of due process issue, which made people feel like the administration was being vindictive and petty. And any time when you combine those things, like at the police car or with the culminating sit-in, which was in December, which grew out of the sending of letters, disciplinary letters to Savio and other free speech movement leaders, that when those things came together, this feeling of, you know, that free speech was being restricted, the civil rights movement was being stifled, and that leadership of the movement was being unfairly singled out for punishment, that together could take people who might have been otherwise disinclined to commit civil disobedience or sit in and convince them to sit in. And by the way, what's really interesting about this, if you look at this, this is a whole semester. Remember, the first major sit-ins are occurring the last day of September and the police car is the first day of October. The culminating sit-in is December 2nd to 3rd. That's almost the whole semester. Some students who oppose the sit-in around the police car in October were part of the mass occupation in which almost 800 students were arrested at Sproul in December, because they'd had several months to look at the situation and to see that, yes, even though they didn't like rule breaking or defying the law and were not eager to do civil disobedience, the objective circumstances had convinced them that this was the only way to win free speech. So a lot of them, if you look at their statements, and I wrote an article about this in my first book on the free speech movement, about the rank and file, but the statements that the students read, there were 515 of them, that they read to the judge just as they were about to be sentenced during the free speech movement trial, explaining why they did what they did. Most of them felt proud of what they did and felt that they were sitting in to try to protect the ideal of what a university should be in terms of the free exchange of ideas and protecting the First Amendment. So even if they'd been very hesitant about breaking the rules, you know, nobody was really eager, or very few people are eager to get arrested or break university rules of risk suspension and expulsion. So the question is, how do you get mainstream students, and so many of them, almost 800 of them, how how do you get them to do that? And part of the reason that happens is because it was a long period of political education in which students realized that, hey, the only way we're going to be able to liberate the university in terms of free speech is by, forcing the issue through civil disobedience. And then what happens is after the mass arrests and the crisis that provoked, plus the Greek crisis, the Greek theater meeting where they tried to drag Mario Savio away from the podium, the police did, for just trying to speak at the end of a faculty administration meeting. On December 8, 64, the faculty votes by over 7-1 in the Academic Senate to support the free speech and consensual demand that the content of speech should not be regulated by the university.
Professor Carlin.
So that's a really important victory. And by the way, it's a victory not only about a student revolt, but it's also a faculty revolt. That's not really understood well.
Okay.
The faculty essentially overruled the administration and governed the university on this issue. That hasn't happened very often in the history of the university, where the faculty takes over.
Okay, Robbie, I'm sorry we're out of time. Professor Cohen, thank you very much. It's been very interesting. We've been talking this morning to Professor Robert Cohen, who's the author of Freedom's Orator, Mario Savio and the Radical Legacy of the 1960s, and is the author of a new book, The Essential Mario Savio.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
This morning, we're talking about the 1964 free speech movement at the University of California at Berkeley. And our next guest is Jack Weinberg. Jack, good morning.
Good morning, Cal.
And Jack, you're the man we've heard a little bit about. You're the man who was in the police car. I wonder if you would mind telling us just a bit about yourself. And you were a Berkeley student in the fall of 64, or you had been, and you were an activist. Could you kind of introduce us to where you were at and what the students were thinking at that time, the active students?
Sure. If we go back to that time, late 1963 and 1964 were the high point of the African-American nonviolent civil rights movement. And I was active in the civil rights movement. In fact, at that time, I was the chairman of the campus chapter of the Congress on Racial Equality, which was a civil rights organization that was carrying out civil rights demonstrations around the country, but particularly in the Bay Area where I was living, over issues of discrimination in employment, discrimination in housing accommodations, and generally speaking, the whole status of African Americans in U.S. society. So I was actively engaged in mobilizing students on the campus. That's what our group did, to support civil rights activities by community-based organizations throughout the Bay Area. That was also the time when the issue of segregation in the Deep South was also a critical issue. We had just had the Mississippi Freedom Summer activities where young people, mainly students from around the country, had gone to Mississippi to register people to vote. It wasn't that you needed outsiders to register people to vote, but it was because until that time, people were intimidated, even murdered in Mississippi for attempting to vote. And there was a need to bring an outside presence to bear witness to that and to give visibility to the issues that came up because of the systematic repression and we now call it vote suppression, but in those days it was much more intense. African Americans in the majority black counties of Mississippi were not allowed to vote at all. So this was a time of very heightened activity on the civil rights movement. the Civil Rights Act of 1964 passed Congress with both Republican and Democratic votes and from all parts of the country other than the Deep South. The country was very polarized, very divided, and with a very intense issue that the standing segregation was no longer in place. When we came back to campus in the fall of 64, our expectations were that this movement would continue and Berkeley students in growing numbers would engage in the civil rights movement. And we were told at the beginning of the semester that we were no longer allowed to hand out leaflets, set up information tables, do any other kind of advocacy in support of civil rights on the campus. And the area that we used to do that, the corner of Bancroft and Telegraph, was now off limits. And so we were told that we could no longer mobilize students for engagement in the civil rights movement. We felt that was outrageous. We could not understand why the University of California, which we had always thought of as an enlightened institution, had suddenly sided with the segregationists. And the free speech movement emerged as a struggle initially for students to regain their rights for advocacy, to participate in the movements of their day, but then expanded into more generally a struggle that the university should place no restrictions on the content of speech on the campus, and it was ultimately successful.
So what were you doing that morning when it sort of all erupted in October, maybe October 1st?
Yeah, it was the morning of October 1st, although actually, to understand what happened that day, it's good to go back to the preceding day. On the day before I was arrested, we had a united front of student organizations, and we decided that we would set up information tables right in the middle of campus and basically violate the rules and see what the university would do. Five students sat down at information tables in front of, say, their gate on campus. A dean approached them, asked for their identification. When they identified themselves, they were given a citation and told to report to the dean's office at 3 p.m. For disciplinary proceedings. As soon as a student got that citation, they stood up and somebody else sat in their place. And after eight students were cited, the deans left, and a crowd had gathered, and approximately 300 people signed a letter saying, "I too sat at the table, and any discipline that you give to these students, you should give to me as well." At 3 o'clock, several hundred people marched into the administration building and insisted that they should all be subject to the same disciplinary proceedings as the eight students who were cited. The administration didn't agree to that, and so a sit-in ensued, and we were in the administration building till past midnight. This was the night before the event that we're talking about when I was arrested. Sometime around midnight, we began a discussion among ourselves and determined that not enough people understood what the issues were and that have a prolonged sit-in, we could just be ignored and we'd run out of steam, so we decided we would leave the building. We left about 2 in the morning, that our groups would again set up tables the next day. This day we would set them right in front of the administration building, which is right at the location on campus that has the highest traffic right at noon. We set them up right at noon, and if we were approached by deans and asked to show identification, we would refuse to cooperate and see what they would do. And so it was noon on the next day, October 1st. Several organizations set up tables. I was sitting at a table of the Congress of Racial Equality. A dean approached me and asked me to identify myself, although he, of course, knew who I was. I refused. He then called the campus police to arrest me. It took some time for the police to bring a car onto the campus to arrest me. Why they needed to bring a car onto the campus, I don't know, since the police headquarters was right in the building we were in front of, but they made a decision to bring a car onto the campus. While they were bringing that car onto campus, I stood up, I made a speech, gathered a crowd, explained what the restrictions were being put on our right to free speech, why we should have that right, what was the importance of the civil rights movement, what was the importance of students taking a stand on the issue of their time. Police car was pulled onto campus. I was put under arrest. I, as was done in those days as part of the civil rights movement, I went limp. They carried me into the police car, and by the time I was placed into the car, it was surrounded, and I ended up sitting in that car surrounded by up to 5,000 or 6,000 students for the next 32 hours. For the next day and a half, I sat in the police car surrounded by students.
Did you have any idea, Jack, it was kind of an iconic moment, or it still is, that there would be that degree of support out there?
I would say the answer is both yes and no. I definitely had an idea the night before that something big would happen the next day. Our campus core group, even though the demonstration ended at 2 in the morning, we didn't go home. We had a meeting, as groups, student groups tend to always do, have meeting after meeting. We had a meeting, and we agreed that we would send a telegraph. Those are the days of telegrams. We sent a telegram to the national headquarters of the Congress on Racial Equality saying, there will be a big event tomorrow on the campus. Send telegrams of support. So we knew that something was going to happen, but we didn't know what. So in that sense, we did anticipate that we were creating a situation that they would have a difficult time responding to without creating some kind of incident. On the other hand, having 5,000 or 6,000 people around supporting us and be willing to do all the things that did take place over the next day and a half, that was beyond my imagination. There had never been more than hundreds of students involved in any activity before that, and suddenly there were thousands. So the scale was both surprising to me and unprecedented in American history.
Right. Jack, now, so from that point until the beginning of December, I guess it was, there was, it seems looking back, like intense activity until the sort of culmination. Is there anything worth remembering about what you did in, I guess, those 2 months of activity on these issues?
I could probably sketch out what happened from the time of my arrest to the culmination in December. I sat in the car, as I said, for a day and a half. On the afternoon of the second day, police forces from around the Bay Area had been mobilized to come to campus to break it up. There were negotiations going on between the university administration and student leaders. And at right about 8 o'clock in the evening, with the administration people saying, we can't hold them back any longer. If we don't reach some kind of agreement soon, the police will wade in. Who knew what they were going to do? So it was a sort of a tense negotiating going on. An agreement was reached between student leaders and the administration, which said I would be released. The charges against me would be dropped. And then a series of a committee of students, faculty, and administration will be established to review the issues that had led to the protests. So that was the end of the students left. The next day, that was a Friday evening. On Saturday, a meeting was held, and the free speech movement was formally established, and its structures were put in place. And then a negotiation process between the students and the administration ensued. Initially, they wanted just to have a committee that they controlled. And, you know, we insisted that this committee was agreed to in a mutual agreement between us and the administration, and that the terms and procedures of that committee also had to be established by mutual agreement. And eventually they gave in to that. And so we had a tripartite committee. The issues were discussed. But at the end of the day, the administration would not yield on one critical point, and that is that they wanted to reserve the right to discipline students in those cases where advocacy on the campus, in their words, quote, led to illegal activity off campus. That is, if there's a demonstration in downtown San Francisco and we hand out a leaflet saying people join that demonstration, if then some kind of civil disobedience happens at that demonstration or some other activity deemed illegal happens at that demonstration, then the students who handed out the leaflet on campus would be subject to disciplinary proceedings. And they would not yield on that point. And the reason they would not yield on that point is because there were members of the Bay Area business community that were insisting that they could not allow students to be mobilized for what they considered attacks on the business community, that is, for demands that discrimination in employment cease, which was then the practice throughout the Bay Area. So that part, that became a sticking point. We could not resolve it. Negotiations broke down. Students began setting up tables again. There were we held large rallies of thousands of people on the Sproul steps to explain what was going on, to put out issues during the two and a half months of the free speech movement. We put out a leaflet every single day explaining what had happened the last day, what the issues were, and so forth. And that continued. By the end of November, we had a situation where on the one hand, we were setting up tables and handing out leaflets and doing those kinds of things, and we're not being stopped from doing them. And on the other hand, the university was reserving the right to discipline students if their activities on campus, quote, led to illegal activities off campus. So we had a standoff. We could no longer violate that one because that was a discretionary thing. The FSM might have ended at that point, but then over Thanksgiving break, the administration sent letters to five student leaders saying that they would be that they were being suspended from school, and that reinvigorated the movement. And the demands became not only our right to no restrictions on the content of speech, but also to rescind this these expulsions of these five students. And so on December 2nd, that was basically 2 months after the police car event, we had a rally on the steps, and over 1,000 students marched into the administration building, Sproul Hall, for a sit-in. That night, the police were called. 800 students were arrested and taken and charged with trespass and other violations and taken off to county jail. While they were being carried off, and it took almost a day to arrest that many people, picket lines were set up at every building on the campus, and the campus went on strike. In all but a handful of departments, the strike was very strongly supported. So classes, with the exception of some business and engineering faculties, pretty much university classes stopped. Even truck drivers were respecting the picket line. So it was a very successful strike. The administration tried one more effort to solve the issue. They called a university-wide meeting at a place called the Greek Theater that can hold 15,000 people, and the administration explained how sympathetic they were to all the great things a student wanted, but blah, blah. And then at the end of that event, Mario Savio, who was the spokesperson and spirit and leader of the free speech movement, walked at the end of the meeting, after it had been adjourned, he walked to the front of the podium to announce that we would hold a rally following that to respond. As he walked onto the stage, he was jumped on by two policemen and knocked to the ground in front of 15,000 people. So this whole meeting that had talked about the need for civility on campus and all that ended with the administration and their police knocking the leader of the free speech movement to the ground in front of everybody else. This was a shocking event. We then had our rally at which faculty members and others had basically said, you know, the situation, you're now in control of the situation. at the free speech movement rally, we made an announcement. We announced that the strike was temporarily suspended pending a meeting the day after, not the following day, but the day after that, of the Academic Senate, and that we called upon the Academic Senate to endorse our demands as a way of bringing this issue to rest. The Academic Senate met, and a resolution passed, something like 800 to 200, basically endorsing the free speech movement, that the free speech movement was right, that there should be no restrictions on the content of speech on the Berkeley campus other than those necessary for time, other than those time, place, and manner regulation necessary for the proper functioning of the university. That was passed overwhelmingly by the faculty. The administration conceded, and a week later, this was acknowledged by the Board of Regents, and the free speech movement was pretty much a total success.
Okay, and just a side point, Jack. The movement, of course, was attacked and belittled by the authorities, led by the governor at the time. But the students' motives were constantly questioned, and yet, if I remember right, hundreds of you went to prison as a result out in Santa Rita. Is that right? Was that important
The governor at the time was Jerry Brown's father, Edmund Brown. Reagan got elected basically by attacking the students and attacking the African Americans, and basically Reagan got elected 2 years later, basically running against, you know, civil rights and running against the unruly students at Berkeley. During the free speech movement, the president of the university, who was a noted liberal, was quoted in the San Francisco paper saying that 49% of the demonstrators are Maoist Castroites, and the media continually, certainly the Bay Area media, portrayed us as communists, or worse than that, communist dupes. That was sort of the notion of every progressive movement, was dupes of the Communist Party in those days. So it was a intense red baiting atmosphere, and in general, in those days, I didn't read the newspapers, because certainly the things that we experienced and we read about in the newspapers, the way it was reported, was very little connected to what actually happened. So there was a big disconnect that time. So we were vigorously attacked, and that was one of the reasons why there was that kind of popular sentiment against the mess at Berkeley that helped get Reagan elected. Afterwards, there was a mass trial, and the leaders, like myself, got 4 month sentences. I got a month off for good behavior, so I served 3 months sentence, in county jail. Many others got a month sentence. Others got probation. Some of the activists refused to accept probation as part of a sentence, because we did not want anything to impede our future activism. So, and it turned out Alameda County Jail wasn't such a bad place, and it helped broaden my perspective on the world. And I guess in balance, it was a good part of my education. But yeah, we did serve jail time as a result of the free speech movement. But that was a small price to pay.
Okay, and you know, Jack, I know you've been active all your life and in several different movements, but you've had plenty of time to think about this all. I wondered if you could just reflect personally on how you feel about these events, looking back at them, and maybe say something about what stands out to you about this experience and its aftermath.
Sure. I mean, the free speech movement was in many ways a turning point in American history. It was not a unique turning point. There were other things that contributed to it. But in some important ways, it was the start of what came to be called retrospectively the 60s. It was the moment when the civil rights movement and its impetus sort of became a force within mainstream society as well. And so the free speech movement was very important. The most immediate impact was, even though the situation vis-a-vis the civil rights movement changed very dramatically after that period, and students who were never again as engaged as we thought they would be in civil rights activities as we moved from integration to black power in that immediate aftermath time, the war in Vietnam began to escalate almost immediately after the end of the free speech movement. And so the rights that we won, a free expression on campus, were most effectively used in building an anti-Vietnam War movement. And throughout the country, universities did not want to get into another free speech fight like the one Berkeley saw. And so basically the right of students throughout the country to mobilize on their campuses against the war in Vietnam was won, even though that's not what we thought we were fighting for. So that was a great impact. A more subtle effect was that if you look at histories of previous wars in the United States, it's not been the case prior to the Vietnam War that governments allowed people to openly protest an ongoing war. World War One, World War Two, Korean War, people who opposed the war were suppressed quite vigorously. There was some oppression during, there was some suppression during the Vietnam War, but nothing like that. I think that the great struggle for the right to free speech that was nationally prominent right before the onset of the escalation of the Vietnam War created an environment which made it much more difficult to suppress the Vietnam War movement. So I think it contributed greatly to an anti-Vietnam War movement of the 1960s. I think it then contributed to the evolving movements, the women's movement, movements for equal justice, culminating in our time in this great successes we're seeing in the gay liberation movement. So social movements really of all kinds, I would say even the environmental movement and the idea of mass engagement, particularly of young people, but of citizens in general in the social movements of their time, got a real impetus from the free speech movement. And so I think it was an important event. I mean, we can also say that 1964 was a turning point. It was also the year that the Beatles and the Rolling Stones arrived in America, where cultural changes happening. Those cultural changes coincided with this young people, idealistic impulse, and all that came together to create the culture of the 60s.
We've been talking with Jack Weinberg, a student activist in Berkeley in the 60s, later a trade union activist and environmentalist. Thank you for joining us for this special series celebrating the 50th anniversary of the free speech movement in Berkeley, California. I'm Cal Winslow. Please join me next week when we talk about the impact of the movement and its aftermath.
Living were a thing that money could buy, you know the rich would live and the poor would die. Oh, my trials, Lord.